I began an unfamiliar backward slide. I slammed the pedal back against the floor.
Just give it a little gas.
Behind me, the drivers honked. I pulled my clutch foot up too fast, and the car sputtered, then went quiet. Someone passed us on the shoulder. Luca reached over and turned the car off, then told me to restart it, but I just glowered at him until the light had gone red again.
Calm down, he said in an unfazed manner I found infuriating.
Fuck this! I wrenched the key in the ignition. The engine howled as I gunned it across the intersection. More honking. I pulled over.
You were doing fine. You have to learn. I can't drive the whole trip.
That was not fine. Lucas sighed.
You're impatient, he said,
which, because it was true, hurt more than a harsher insult. We switched places.
You're driving once we get out of Zagreb,
he said, and flipped on the radio. On the highway, I was calmer. I was driving again, but without stop signs and traffic lights, it was easier. We took off our shoes, threw them in the back seat, cranked down the windows, and let the breeze flow through the car. The air was hot, but at least it was moving. The dashboard vibrated with the folk-techno mashups that pervaded the country's airwaves. A mix of traditional Muslim and Mediterranean melodies overlaid with thumping house beats, they'd become the new post-war pop. A far cry from the nationalistic anthems of our childhood, they were what Luca termed a cultural ceasefire, an effort to bring the segregated nationalities back into communion with one another.
I like the new songs, he said,
fiddling with the dial to clear out the static as we passed the last of Zagreb's suburbs.
It's genius, really. People in the discotheque, all drunk, rubbing up against each other to music that everyone thinks came from their own heritage.
Outside of Zagreb, things quickly became rural. Sheep and chickens and rows of corn along the roadside, and it was hard to tell one farm or cluster from the next. Luca spoke about the end of the war and which friends from elementary school were doing what, and I told him stories about Rahela and American High School and New York City. I looked at the clock. We'd been driving for a few hours. Bullet-dented road signs showed we were approaching the place where the road split toward Sarajevo. I got nervous and swerved to follow a sign toward Plitvice Lakes National Park. Luca noticed but didn't say anything. Plitvice was famously beautiful, even outside Croatia, and I'd never been there, so it was an easy enough stop to justify. At the park, I pulled my camera from the trunk and slung its oversized strap across my chest. We talked our way through the front gate without paying. The woman manning the booth said she was just relieved to hear someone speaking Croatian. She could go a whole day without coming across another Croat, she said, spent hours conversing in pantomime and broken English with tourists from Italy and France. The German tourists were better, she said, because she knew a little German.
Everyone learns German in school now, because they were quick to recognize us as a country, Luca said to me.
His sidebar didn't slow the park attendant down at all. The problem with the Germans was that they were a little rude and all dressed like Boy Scouts, and anyway, we should go in if we liked, because it was silly that Croats should have to pay to see their own park.
Once, when the war was just over, my mother and I went to Germany to visit her sister,
Luca said, as we passed through the gate and onto the main trail.
I was 15 and wearing a Croatian flag t-shirt. Police Academy issue, and in the Frankfurt airport, a man came up to me and asked me if I was Croatian.
Never a good sign.
I said yes, and he said he'd lived in Germany for a long time, but was a Croat too, and was sorry for all I'd had to go through. He gave us a box of expensive chocolate and walked off. That was the only good thing I ever got just for being a Croat. Until now.
I guess this was a first for me, I said. Once on the subway, I'd stared too long at a couple speaking Serbian, lingering in a manner that must have betrayed comprehension.
Govorite serbski?
the boyfriend had asked. Harvatsky. Oh, they'd said simultaneously. The boyfriend had stuck out his hand, and we'd shaken. We'd spent a few minutes in desperate friendliness, and I'd gotten off at the next stop, which wasn't mine. Nothing good had come from that. They'd looked embarrassed, and I was late for class. Luca and I passed a gilded plaque laid in the ground that read, In memory of Josip Jovich. Plitvice had been at the center of the war before the war even began. The region was one of the first to be seized because the Serbs wanted cross-country access to the sea. During the takeover, which came to be called Bloody Easter, Croat and Serb police forces had clashed, and the resultant dead officers, one on each side, were eulogized as martyrs. It was months before the air raid started, but technically, the war's first blood spilled here. The edge of the park didn't look like much. We were still at a high elevation, and we'd have to hike down to get to the water. We examined the map the woman in the window had given us and decided on a route that would take us past the biggest waterfall. The lakes, the pamphlet suggested, were named entirely after legendary people who had drowned in them.
I wonder what they called them before all these people drowned, Luca said, stuffing the paper in his back pocket.
Probably nothing. No need to differentiate.
Why were they all drowning anyway? It's a lake. It's not like you get caught in a riptide.
Did your dad know the guys who fought here?
Huh?
On Kurvavi Uskurs. The cops who got killed.
God, I forgot about that. Is this too close for comfort?
The whole country is too close for comfort, I said. I'd meant it to sound like a joke, but it came out wobbly, and Luca didn't laugh. Let's just go look at the water. Surely there's a reason all these Germans are wandering around a sad little battlefield.
He didn't know the guy, Luca said. I think he was from Zagora.
We arrived at the edge of a bluff and peered down at the lakes, the water a shocking turquoise. The shallows were bridged by wooden slat walking paths, and the sound of the falls overwhelmed the garble of foreign languages. The place was so obviously beautiful it was almost disturbing. Perhaps people had drowned here because they'd wanted to, or at least allowed themselves to succumb to that unfathomable blue. Its beauty was completely unmarred by the bloodshed, and it was easy to see how tourists could push all that history from their minds. We found a secluded place at the bottom of the canyon to put our feet in the water. Touching the water wasn't allowed, a sign in several languages warned. But Luca didn't seem worried about the rules, and I was emboldened by the ticket woman at the gate who'd called the place mine. The water was clear and warm, and I watched a fish brush against Luca's ankle. He flinched, then faked a cough to pretend he hadn't noticed. I laughed and switched on my camera. The camera was a Polaroid, the pop-up kind, which I'd bought at a garage sale before I'd gone to college. I'd purchased it out of a desire to be interesting. Gardenville could bring out that kind of desperation in a person. The camera gears whirred, and Luca looked startled by the mechanical grinding amid the white noise of rushing water.
What is that?
He said, right as I snapped a picture. The camera churned the photo square from its front slot. A specter of Luca materialized, mouth agape and eyes wide and black against the brilliant blue background. I held the photo up, and he scoffed.
That's so American.
It wasn't the response I'd been expecting, and I knew he didn't mean it in a good way. It's not, I said, defensive. It's old. People had Polaroids here, too.
Seriously, what's more instant gratification than this?
He flicked the photo.
You can be nostalgic within 3 minutes.
It's not like that. This photo's one of a kind, impossible to copy. It's like art.
Art, eh?
Luca said, taking the photo and shaking it. That actually doesn't work, shaking it. It's a myth. He stopped and handed me the photo. We drew our feet from the water and let them dry on the cracked wood. Then I stood and slipped the Polaroid into my pocket. I thought of Sebald and his photos. Maybe they were his way of bypassing the slipperiness of memory. Anyway, they're for Rahela, I said. We trekked up out of the valley and back toward the car and the road and the coast. Luca's mind was a cavernous place I couldn't navigate, though the ambling course of our conversations was familiar. I was both fascinated and annoyed by his willingness to pull apart things I would have left in one piece, just like he had when we were small.
"Communism is fascism in all practical applications," he was saying now. "Can you think of a communist country sans dictator?"
But I was thinking of Rebecca West, of how the people she'd met in Yugoslavia were all killed or enslaved, tangled up in this same debate at the start of the Second World War. Croatia had been on the wrong side of history then, a puppet state of the Germans and Italians, and had killed its share of innocents. I hated this most of all, that my anger could not be righteous against such a murky backdrop.
"True," Luca said when I mentioned the fascist faction in the 40s. "But before that, they were starving us out. We couldn't even own land. We've been fighting for thousands of years, and most of those guys got executed when Tito came into power. That's just how it is."
He spoke with some finality, and I was relieved when the conversation swelled past the ghosts of ex-governments and into a broader sweep of ethics. We began with Voltaire. Luca loved the witty attack on religious dogma, it being the driving force behind our ethnic tensions as far as he was concerned, and pushed up through Foucault, whose amoral take on power infuriated him. I, all the while, feeling that my American education had left me remarkably ill-equipped for a discussion of philosophy. Luca seemed to have read at least chunks of the seminal texts in high school, while I kept up by regurgitating lines from the single critical theory course I'd taken my freshman year, until I saw a sign that marked the impending road split. I pulled over and reached for the map in the glove compartment.
"What are you looking for?" said Luca. "You just need to follow the signs for Dubrovnik."
I ignored him and traced my finger along the road, squinting to read the names of the smallest villages. Luca put his arm across my lap, blocking the map.
"Anna, look at me."
"What?"
"I'm here. I'll go with you wherever you want. But you can't shut me out."
"I'm not..."
"Whatever it is, maybe I can help."
"I don't exactly have a master plan here."
"I could have asked my dad for old intel or something. You should just be honest with me."
"I know. I know."
"You promise?"
"I promise," I said. It was a lie even as it was coming out of my mouth. There was still one thing I hadn't told him, had never told anyone.
"Okay,"
he said.
"Where do you want to go?"
I pointed to a part of the road with a bend like a boomerang and restarted the car. Back on the road, I felt almost dizzy with anticipation. I'd pictured a return to this place hundreds of times, had dreaded it, and yearned for it. But in all my imaginings, it never involved feeling so faint. I studied the landscape for clues, but nothing was familiar, or everything looked the same. We passed strips of black pine and ash, some vibrant green, some blackened and bare from wildfires. I white-knuckled the steering wheel and pushed my foot down hard against the gas pedal. I could see Luca watching me from the corner of his eye.
"What are you doing?"
"Nothing."
"Do you want me to drive?"
"I'm fine." The tree line was becoming less patchy, more mature, until thick bands of white oak lined both sides of the highway.
"Seriously, Anna, you're going too fast. The cops will double the bribe if they see your American license."
I glanced at the quivering needle of the speedometer, but didn't slow down.
"If you just pull over, I can..."
"I don't want to stop here." A small side road, almost completely obscured by overgrowth, caught my eye. I craned my neck to watch it take a steep drop down into a valley. Luca protested again, but I shushed him. My stomach lurched, but I tried to ignore it. There were probably a lot of villages in the valley, with a lot of sinuous little offshoots that followed the same arc. Then, after a few minutes, the main road made a harsh curve, and I knew. Oh my God.
What is it?
I slammed on the brakes and swerved to the shoulder. We slid to a stop on the roadside grass, the smell of burning brake pads drifting through the open windows.
What the hell, Anna? Are you crazy?
No, was the correct answer, the one I wanted to say. But instead, what came out was, probably, then a wet, congested sound in my chest. Lucas sighed and dropped a hand on my knee, and I cried the kind of suffocating sobs I hadn't since I'd been on the other side of this same road 10 years before. Part 3. Safe House. Chapter 1. My eyes burned. The sun sat on the horizon, and I walked toward it. The road forked. The main road was big and level, and the smaller road was unpaved and sloped down into the lowlands. A spiral of smoke twisted up from the valley, beckoning me with a wispy finger. The big road said nothing. I followed the smoke. It led me to the center of a village, down a rocky street lined with houses. A woman wrapped in a purple shawl was feeding leftover crusts to emaciated chickens in her yard. I felt her looking, but kept walking. As I got closer, her mouth slackened at the sight of me, a tiny, blood-crusted zombie soaked in other people's bodily fluids. She approached, called out to me. I stopped in the middle of the street. She came to me and kneeled, asked my name, where I was from, what had happened. I tried to determine from her accent whether or not she was a Serb, if it was safe to speak to her. I couldn't tell, and decided it didn't really matter, that I had nowhere else to go, and I might as well answer. But somewhere along the way, my body had taken a vow of silence. She talked and talked, and I stayed quiet. She reached for my hand, and I vomited on the asphalt. In the end, she grabbed my arm and led me to her house. She stood over me and rinsed the blood from my wrists. It was only cold water, but the cuts were dirty, and it stung. My eyes welled up, but no tears escaped. For the first week, I sat on her kitchen floor with my back to the wall and my knees to my chest. I counted the squares in the linoleum, stared at the crack in the dining table leg, scratched at my gauze-wrapped wrists. I blinked rarely and moved with a halting, mechanical edge. At night, I slept in the same spot, curling into a knot on the floor. The woman's son, a boy a few years older than I was, left the house early each morning and came home after dark. He stomped around in combat boots and talked incessantly of the safe house. It was a phrase I'd never heard before, and I assumed it was the village's bomb shelter. The boy never spoke to me, walked in wide arcs around my spot as if I had a contagious illness. I felt like I did. The woman gave me water in a tin cup and bread with butter, but it was hard to eat. Even breathing was a conscious effort. The first few times the air raid siren sounded, the woman tried to coax me into going to the shelter with her, but I stayed in my corner. The explosions of that first week were inconsequential. I was anesthetized to fear. The woman had visitors who entered under various pretenses and examined me from the corners of their eyes, but spoke as if I wasn't there at all.
Maybe she's just stupid, someone offered.
Maybe she's mute.
She's not stupid,
said the woman, whose name these conversations revealed was Drenka.
It's not that she can't talk. She just won't. I can tell.
Seems to me she got a shock, said one of the kinder old women. I saw her all bloodied up when you found her.
Eventually, my novelty wore off, and I became privy to the women's gossip. Stories about the mixed Serb-Croat family who had lived across the street and disappeared in the middle of the night, about the next-door neighbor's daughter, who was 15 and pregnant. The JNA Air Force had crushed the village at the start of the war as part of their mission to make a Serbian path to the sea. Afterward, a small band of Chetnik rebels, some of them villagers themselves, had taken control. The Chetniks made alternating rounds between this village and several others along the same stretch of highway, interdicting humanitarian aid and Croatian military supplies and holding down the settlements as way stations for their own convoys. They had decided not to kill us, at least not all of us, not yet, so the UN and NATO food aid would keep coming. When they were in town, the Chetniks maintained headquarters in the schoolhouse at the center of the village, the shutters lashed closed with a convoluted twist of bungee cords. From the women's screams, everybody knew what happened inside. "Now you will give birth to a little Serb soldier," they had told the neighbor girl as they raped her. When she came to borrow flour, I stared at the stained brown shirt stretched thin over her growing stomach. I left the house for the first time when the chickens exploded. These days, the JNA bombed the village sporadically, almost as if by accident. The initial detonations resulted in predictable damage, blown-out buildings, shattered glass, but the real danger lay in the clearing smoke. As the bombs fell, they released showers of tiny metal balls. The outside world called them cluster bombs. We called them zvončići, jingle bells. They were not like traditional landmines or trip wires constructed to kill in combat zones. Zvončići clung to tree branches and roof tiles, nestled in patches of grass. They fell indiscriminately, like combustible hail. They were patient, making up for what they lacked in size with the element of surprise. They had surprised the chickens. The blast shook the floor, and I jumped up and ran out the front door. The sun hurt my eyes, and on unsteady legs I strained to keep up with Drenka and her son. Behind the house a cloud of feathers was settling, and I tried not to look. Most of the village sat along a single street, the homes unvarying in style and size. Exposed cinder block was the prevailing facade in those mountains, chosen to say, "We are sturdy and permanent." But the gray brick appeared perpetually unfinished, blurting out instead, "We are poor." Now riddled with shell fragments, the pockmarked houses looked even more dismal. Beyond them, uneven plots of farmland sprawled along the valley, a collage of mottled greens and browns, singed fields of wheat and corn. At the traffic circle were the school the Chetniks had commandeered and the Catholic church, which likely, because it was missing a wall, they had left alone. There was also a post office and a market, though neither functioned, not the way they should. An armored truck delivered UN flour, milk powder, and vegetable fat to the post office. No one could say for sure whether they'd seen actual peacekeepers in person, and depending on the week, whether or not the Chetniks were around, either we got it or we didn't. In the shelter, seeing everyone at once, I noticed that the villagers had uniformed up in various shades of olive. They studied my bloodied t-shirt with equal interest. Some people had uniforms with Hungarian writing stamped on them, leftovers from their revolution decades earlier, but most just wore any combination of green they could put together. Afterward, when we returned to her house, Drenka offered me the smallest green attire she had, a t-shirt and cargo pants with a patch over the knee, which her son had outgrown. "Now that you're going outside," she said. Reluctantly, I surrendered my own clothes to her for washing. I wanted to tell her not to get rid of them. She seemed to understand, or else she didn't want to be wasteful. She didn't throw them out. Outside, I learned about running. Not the bouncy, pleasurable kind I'd done while playing football or tag with my friends, but a streamlined, adrenaline-injected version of my normal stride. Once I started, I ran everywhere. To the water pump, to the post office for UN food, to the underground shelter. When one was maneuvering from house to bomb shelter, it might at first seem logical to travel in as straight a line as possible, to take the quickest way. But I always ran in a haphazard zigzag. believing I could upset the statistical probabilities of hitting a landmine by forging an incoherent path, believing, in the egocentric mindset of all children, that I was the main target. I was afraid one of the soldiers had seen me pretending to die in the forest, and now, spotting me alive and well, was out to finish what he'd started. After a while, though, I noticed that others were running in crooked lines, too. When the Chetniks climbed the rooftop of the school and sprayed bullets along the road, it was clear we were justified in our self-centeredness. Somewhere in the dead space between house and shelter, civilians became soldiers. A few days after the chicken's demise, Drenka's son talked to me for the first time.
"I'm Damir."
I'd known his name already, but this was the first time he'd addressed me directly, and I nodded as if he'd told me something new.
"You can come with me if you'd like."
He handed me a khaki sweatshirt and a camouflage cap, then walked out the door without checking to see whether I was coming. The shirt was huge and smelled sweaty, but I pulled it on anyway. Over the weeks, I'd come to like Damir, the confident way he marched around the house, the excited chatter about his safe house, which I was piecing together, was not the same as the shelter. Could he be inviting me there? Pressing the hat down hard on my head, I followed him into the street. He ducked down an alley and through the side door of a house perforated with bullet holes. The safe house had once been just a regular house, though no one ever spoke of whose it was or what had happened to them. Inside, my eyes watered. The rooms were dim, shutters drawn, and the whole place was cloaked in a nicotine haze. Damir was talking to the front door guards, and I hung as close to him as I could without being a nuisance, studying the house as my vision cleared. On the walls were pictures of well-oiled, topless women, and the deep-browed, prominent-nosed face even I recognized as General Ante Gotovina, whose likeness was fast becoming the logo of the Croatian resistance. Ultra-nationalist slogans were spray-painted on every smooth surface, walls, doors, countertops. Za dom spremni, for the home, ready. The furniture was smashed, save for one red leather chair in the middle of the kitchen, which no one ever sat in. Gotovina's chair, we called it. I followed Damir up the stairs to the top floor, a single large room that seemed inexplicably bright, until I realized a chunk of the roof was missing.
"Wait here,"
he said, and I got nervous. I watched Damir approach an ancient man with glasses so thick the lenses protruded from their frames. They spoke in low voices while I stood in the doorway. Despite the winter chill, just as noticeable inside because of the missing roof, the man wore only jeans and a sleeveless undershirt that revealed dry, scabbed arms. The man looked over at me as Damir talked, then raised a hand in my direction and motioned for me to come. I heard his knees crunch as he bent down to my eye level.
"What's your name there?"
he said.
"She, doesn't talk," Damir said. "Never mind that. We're not looking for speech makers. We need workers. I can see you're a tough guy."
Behind the glasses, his eyes were magnified round like an insect's, and I was doubtful about whether he could see anything at all, but I liked that he'd called me tough, and I smiled a little. He tugged on the brim of my cap.
"An adventurer, maybe?"
I didn't know what that had to do with anything, but I wanted the captain to like me, so I nodded. He extended a knobby hand, and I tapped it in a hesitant high five.
"Okay. Indiana Jones it is."
He pressed himself back into a standing position and put his hand on Damir's shoulder.
"Why don't you go set her up with Stallone?"
"Yes, sir,"
Damir said, removing an AK from its spot on a hat rack before guiding me to the back of the room, away from the windows. The safe house was populated by leftovers, the elderly and teenaged, men too old to be drafted, and boys like Damir, technically too young to fight. The Safehausers had replaced their given names with those of American action movie icons. The house contained two Bruces, a Lee and a Willis, Corleone, Bronson, Snake Plissken, Scarface, Van Damme, Leonardo, Donatello, of the Turtles, not the painters, they were quick to assert, and several men from the next town over who answered to the general appellation, Wolverines. Though I didn't know enough about the movies to decode the system, the nicknames were usually assigned by vote and were somewhat indicative of rank. Damir, for his valor in an operation past, had been awarded the most coveted moniker, Rambo. I was the only girl there. In the corner we found Stallone, a boy about my age, swathed in ammo belts and sporting an eye patch of indeterminate medical necessity.
"What's your name?" he said.
"She's Indiana," Damir said. "She'll be with you now."
"Indiana Jones?" he seemed impressed. "Where are you from?"
I looked up at Damir, but he had already gone.
"You don't talk?"
I shook my head. He raised his hands in a series of gestures synchronous with his speech.
"You deaf?"
I shook my head again.
"My brother's deaf," he said.
He pointed to a gunner at the side window, the only person of regular military age in the house.
"The Terminator!"
The floor around Stallone was littered with bullets and cartridges. I cleared a place beside him and sat down.
"Okay," he said. "This is how you do it."
From then on, I reloaded magazines. My fingers were small and agile, perfect for filling the clips. I sat on the floor with Stallone amid piles of munitions, sorting and loading. The ammo, Stallone said, was smuggled in through Hungary too, or Romania, or the Czech Republic, countries who knew what it meant to overthrow a communist government and were willing to ignore the EU embargo. Stallone also manned the CB radio, taking in strings of garbled code from other safe house strongholds across the region, and alerting the captain of JNA plane sightings or Chetnik activity in the neighboring towns. Sometimes we picked up broadcasts from the Croatian police force, and I took their coordinates and labeled them on a map on the back wall. When we caught their frequency, Stallone always sent an SOS to see if they were coming to get us, but we never heard back.
"Must be busy,"
Stallone would say, and readjust his eye patch. A rough-and-ready army unit, most of the Safehausers went out on missions for days at a time, leaving only a skeleton crew back at headquarters to protect the town. We'd fill large sacks with ammo for the men to take on their trips, and after we finished all the packs, I'd run through the house distributing new belts and collecting the empties from the rest of the gunners. Though the house had three floors, we almost exclusively used the top one. It was better to have the higher ground, to shoot at a downward angle. The room lacked any peacetime artifacts, but the parts of the ceiling that remained were so steeply sloped it was clear we were in the attic. The best gunners got the prime real estate of the front dormer window, so I resupplied them first, then the side window shooters, and then the door guards, who were the only people on the ground floor. Like everywhere else in the village, the safe house had no running water or electricity, and the shuttered-up first floor was dark as night at all hours. Besides equipping the guards, using the bathroom was the only reason to go downstairs. The shadowy lower rooms were by far the scariest parts of the house, and I approached both tasks with breakneck speed. The actual bathroom had exploded in an air raid. It had been boarded off and replaced by an unfortunate replica in the coat closet, complete with bucket, hand-crank flashlight, and UN-issue toilet paper. Whoever got on the captain's bad side during the course of the day would be saddled with the foul duty of emptying the bucket in the evening. Each night when we returned from the safe house, after the second shift took over, Damir would settle opposite his mother at the kitchen table to suck down root soup and played touch. While we were at the safe house, I was busy, felt useful, but at night I longed for my parents, ran their final moments through my head. In that first month, I wasn't quite mourning. Instead, my mind felt hazy and detached, crowded with ideas I knew weren't true, even as I entertained them. Maybe, if I worked hard enough, I could win them back. For days, I choked down my bread and watched from my spot on the floor as Drenka and Damir fumbled in the candlelight, rushing to slap piles of dog-eared playing cards together. I felt suspended between living and dead, as if joining them would mean abandoning my own family. And yet, every evening I found myself inching closer to the table, my shadow elongated in the flickering light, until eventually I sat down to play too. If they were surprised by my appearance there, they didn't show it. Damir made a bad joke, and Drenka laughed at it anyway, and I felt a smile push its way up through me. Her brown face glowed gold in the low light. The next night, I sat at the table at dinner time too, and ate soup and bread with preserves. Before she blew out the candles, Drenka spread a sheet across the sofa and called me over. I felt my spine lengthen like it hadn't during the weeks of sleeping contracted on the kitchen floor, and I stretched my arms over my head and pushed myself deep into the cushions of the couch. Chapter 2. I'd been working at Safe House headquarters for a few weeks when the girls showed up. Mostly teenagers, the girls had been on a reconnaissance mission down south, but had been waylaid by a JNA battle outside Kanin. Now they returned bearing updates from the surrounding towns. They stomped up to the attic, muddy and commanding attention, then reeled off a list of names from a receipt paper scroll. From the reactions of the safehousers, I gleaned that it was the latest in casualties or missing persons from the front. After the announcements, the conversation descended quickly into the realm of justs, speculations leveled at the bearer of the list. "He'll be fine. He's just missing, not wounded." "Just shot," it says. "Not necessarily killed." "Probably only a flesh wound." The list reader scanned her paper in an attempt to offer some affirmative responses to the barrage. I'd always assumed Damir's father was in the army, but Damir never mentioned him, and he didn't come up on the list while I was there. When people got frantic, the captain stepped in and took the paper. He folded it in a lopsided accordion and attempted to put it in his shirt front pocket, before realizing that he wasn't wearing a shirt, and stuffing it in his waistband instead.
"The boys are all fine," he said firmly, and everyone dispersed back to their posts.
"Who are you?" said one of the girls when she came to get a new clip. She wore a patrol cap and long auburn hair and fiddled with both as she talked.
"She's Indy," Stallone said, having grown accustomed to his role as my spokesperson. "Indiana Jones." He turned to me, lowering his voice.
"That's Red Sonja. She's the girl boss."
There was a philosophical divide in the safe house about whether or not the girls should take on exclusively female nicknames. Some argued that they didn't want their pick of badass characters limited on the basis of gender, while Red Sonja said there were plenty of worthy women action stars who were actually more badass than their male counterparts, given they had to fight in tighter pants.
"Indy," she said, frowning, no doubt at the gender attached to my adopted name. "Well, too late to change it. Nice job with this, though."
She gestured at my latest organizational effort for munitions, bullets separated by cartridge type and stored in terracotta flower pots. I gave her a thumbs up, and she tied off the braid she'd plaited during the exchange and went to reload. Sorted munitions made the safe house run smoother, but the older girls all had their own assault rifles, and I was getting restless. I had proven myself a good worker, I thought, and wanted to fight like everybody else. The following week, during morning meetings, when weapons were issued to the new recruits from neighboring villages, I lined up with the rest, tucked my hair up under my cap, and hoped the dirt on my face covered any traces of girlhood. The captain looked me up and down and said there was not enough for everyone. But the next day, we took on mortar fire that tore a new hole in the south wall. The captain made Stallone and me lie face down on the floor, and I loathed the familiar feeling of helplessness. I tried to lift my head, but could only see boots. Someone fell beside me, I couldn't tell who, and his weapon discharged as he hit the floor. A hollow, wobbling tone filled my ears, then a roaring sound like rushing water. The man was bleeding in spurts from his neck, and I closed my eyes again. Afterward, I sat up and looked around. Stallone was beside me, pressing his sleeve to a slash across his forehead, saying something I couldn't hear. My ears were still ringing. I took the gun from the dead man next to me, a Wolverine, and slipped its strap over my head. No one noticed. There were three other men on the floor, not moving. Red Sonja had me rip a bedsheet into squares, and she closed the dead men's eyes and covered their faces with the fabric. The Bruces were stacking weapons, guns and knives and brass knuckles newly available. I pushed the gun up against my back and knew from that moment it was mine. The strongest men heaved the corpses down the stairs and laid them out behind the house, waiting for nightfall so they could transport them to the cemetery at the far end of the village. At dusk, Stallone and I went out on recon and counted Chetnik casualties. We kicked the bodies, searched their pockets for ammo. Damir taught me how to field strip and reassemble an AK. Forward grip, gas chamber, cleaning rod, bolt, piston first, frame, magazine. Function check. It meant to cock the gun as a test, the last step in reassembly, but anyone completing the check yelled it triumphantly, a battle cry preceding the first bursts of gunfire. The field strip was a protocol that never changed, and I found solace in the repetition. The old men let me keep watch while they were eating lunch. Too short to shoot with my feet on the ground, I'd climb up and kneel in the windowsill. I shot over toward the schoolhouse at anything in camouflage moving in the windows or outside ground level on the other side of the street, then jumped down and ducked in case a Chetnik was clear-headed enough to shoot straight back. With every round, I envisioned killing the soldier with the brown teeth, the one who'd struck my father in the back of the knee and laughed. I relished the power that seemed to run through the chamber of the weapon directly up into my own veins. Occupation under the Chetniks was a delicate balance. In their state of perpetual intoxication, they'd been satisfied in rape and pillage mode, their genocidal appetites satiated by picking off safe houses and the occasional roadside murder of travelers like my parents. The danger of killing too many of us and losing their UN meal ticket staved off any large-scale assaults. But the JNA, closing in on the area, sent reinforcements, and the reinforcements were not yet weary of the place, were not content with exchanging fire from the comfort of the schoolhouse. They had salaries, uniforms, better weapons, and a functioning chain of command. Relatively, they were sober. They were ready to attack. I was at the attic window keeping watch with the Terminator when we spotted a band of armored vehicles, about 10 it looked like, but it was hard to tell from the curve in the road. The trucks were green, not UN issue, and when I looked up at the Terminator, he was gesturing frantically. I bolted across the attic to get Stallone, who, upon seeing his brother's signs, yelled, "Holy shit! The JNA! They're coming down the street!" The trucks were closer now, and I could see the red Yugoslavian stars on their doors.
"Let's move," said the captain,
and everyone who'd been without a gun lunged for the extras on the hat rack. I turned to the captain for his next instructions, but from downstairs we heard gunfire, the blowback of broken glass, and the door guard screaming.
"They're here," said Stallone.
We ran, down the uneven rear stairs and out the back door, through the packed dirt alley by the market, and out into the wheat fields. The stalks bowed with rotting, grain-laden heads abandoned by farmers when the bombing started, but even in their hunched posture, they were taller than I was, and I could see nothing but wheat in all directions. I wondered where Stallone had gone. Then, from a side row, I saw Damir darting toward me.
"You've got speed, girl,"
he said when he caught up. He grabbed me by the hood of my sweatshirt and yanked me to the left, hard.
"No sense of direction, though."
The butt of my rifle banged a bruise into the back of my leg as we ran. A pack of JNA foot soldiers were coming from the other side of the field now. There were at least 20 of them, running in a clean, arrow-like formation. I froze, gaping as they closed the meters between us. 100, 75, 50. But Damir pushed me ahead of him and released a spray of gunfire on them. In the corner of my vision, I saw him go down, but he yelled,
"Don't stop!"
So I kept running, made a sharp turn into the field's middle strip. The wind hit my face fresh and hard, my nose dripped, and my eyes watered. Dragging my sleeve across my face, I pumped my legs faster until I could no longer feel the ground, until gravity slithered off the treads of my sneakers. At the center of the field, I threw myself beneath a tractor and curled into a compact ball, covering my face with my hands. There was gunfire and yelling from every angle, and I tried to listen for voices I knew. I thought of Damir and waited for the familiar sadness to set in, but found only anger in its place. With one hand, I felt the ground for my AK and was relieved to find it there beside me.
"Vici Akamoshish!"
Yell out if you can. The cry reverberated through the village as the remaining safehousers combed the fields for survivors.
"Vici Akamoshish!"
Other than the rescue call, it was eerily quiet, that odd part of evening when the sun had set, but it was still more light than dark. I ran my hands over my face and body, taking inventory, impossibly unharmed, save for the blood on my wrists, where the last of the barbed wire scabs had reopened when I hit the ground. I waited, listening for any definitive JNA sounds, watched for passing boots. But there was nothing, so I pulled myself on my elbows out from beneath the tractor. It occurred to me that I'd never seen a tractor up close before, and I marveled momentarily at its size, the tire alone taller than I was, before a resurgence of the rescue call returned me to soldier mode. I jogged back the way I'd come, looking for Damir, and found a group of safehousers squatting around a body I knew must be his.
"Indy," Bruce Willis said, noticing me. Don't look. Go home and tell Drenka to make a bed for him." "She doesn't talk," said Snake. "Well, then she'll do a goddamn charade. Just go."
I pressed myself on tiptoe, trying to catch a glimpse of Damir's face to see if Bruce had meant a sick bed or a dead person one, but Damir was obscured by the men around him.
"Hey,"
Bruce said, and I spun back toward them.
"Hold the gun out in front of you, at least till you get out of the field."
I nodded and pulled the AK up over my head, adjusting the twisted strap around my shoulder. Damir was right. My sense of direction was terrible, and now that the men had turned me away from the path toward the safe house, I'd lost my reference point. I walked down a row of wheat, but that only seemed to take me deeper into the field. Ahead, I thought I heard a rustling. I had practiced the field strip so many times that cocking the gun was more an act of muscle memory than conscious thought. I pulled the handle back along the bolt carrier, then released it, heard a round click into the chamber. Whoever was nearby must have heard it too, because there was rustling again, then the unmistakable sound of running in boots. I tried to call for Stallone, but nothing came out. When he came around the corner, I froze. It was not Stallone. The man was looking over his shoulder, but was headed straight for me. He wore a patchy beard and a green jacket, no JNA insignia. By the time he turned and saw me, we were so close we could have touched. He was visibly shocked by my size and my gun. I felt him look me over, trying to decide what to do, and for a moment I glimpsed his hesitation. Then it passed. He reached around for his gun, and I squeezed my eyes shut and pulled the trigger. On the ground, the man was writhing and making a choking noise. I had hit him in the upper stomach, or maybe the ribs. He was probably only a few years older than Damir, acne pockmarks still visible along his cheekbones. The blood was passing through his shirt and pooling beside him. But he was still awake, wide-eyed and angry and confused. He was trying to talk, but his speech was slurred, and I couldn't understand until he stopped whatever he had been saying and just repeated,
"Please,"
over and over again. I didn't know what else to do, so I stepped over him and crept through the wheat, searching for a way back to the house. In the kitchen, I called out to Drenka, but my vocal cords groaned with the vibrations of disuse. She turned and looked me over, trying to gauge whether I'd actually spoken. I saw her eyes catch on something and realized I was covered in blood, a little from my wrists, but mostly from the blowback of the soldier. I coughed and tried again to speak. My voice came stronger this time.
"Damir's hurt."
She jumped from her chair.
"Where is he?" "The JNA. They got him."
My throat burned.
"Safehausers are bringing him here. They said to get ready."
"Get ready? What does that mean?"
"I don't know."
Drenka instructed me to undress. I put on her nightgown as she wrung the blood from my clothes in a bucket on the kitchen floor. Damir had been shot in the thigh, and the bullet was still inside him. It took two safehausers to carry him because they were trying to keep his leg straight. When they first put him on his bed, I still couldn't tell if he was alive. But when Drenka cut his pant leg off and poured alcohol on the wound, he jerked awake and began to yell.
"Thank God,"
I said. Bruce Willis stared at me, then tried to play off his surprise at my speaking. The Bruces sat with us for a few hours, assuring Drenka that Damir was going to be fine. The captain was already radioing the neighboring villages to call for the doctor, they said. I thought of the soldier I had shot, wondered if he had been rescued, or if he was still out in the field, bleeding to death. Damir moaned and sweated in his sleep. Drenka and I stayed up all night staring at him and waiting for the doctor to come. He mumbled incessantly about his grandfather and watermelon, while Drenka cradled his head and poured swallows of rakia in his mouth.
"Listen,"
she said to me the next morning as I slung my gun over my shoulder and double-knotted my shoelaces.
"If you tell me where you're from, I can help you get back. There must be someone waiting for you."
I eyed her from across the table until she resumed her pacing. I thought about what it would be like if the doctor had to cut off Damir's leg in front of us, right in his own bed. I thought of Luca knocking on the door of our flat, of his impatience and worry at the silence on the other side. The red shine of his bicycle streaked across my vision. I thought about the man I had shot, but I was not quite sorry. I went to the safe house. There was no one guarding the door. Inside, the house was trashed. The posters had been torn from the wall, their taped corners clung obstinately to the cement. It looked like Gotovina's chair had been set on fire. I ran upstairs, where I found the captain warbling a distress signal into the CB. Besides the Bruces and one of the turtles, the place was empty.
"Stallone?"
I managed, my voice still clumsy. The captain looked startled, but quickly regained composure.
"A lot of people are okay. They're at home, healing up for a day or two."
"Stallone?"
I said again, taking note of the captain's evasion.
"Stallone is missing," he said. "His brother is out looking."
I stood there frozen, the strength I'd gained over the past months gone all at once, as if it had drained out my feet.
"Don't worry about that now. Tell me about Damir."
I told him Damir's leg was swollen and oozing something yellow.
"He needs help," I said. "He's dreaming of his dead grandfather."
"Indy, you must go home and take care of Drenka now. The doctor will be there soon."
I stood there, immobile, which the captain mistook for protest.
"That's an order,"
he said, so I gathered myself and went. In Damir's room, the curtains were drawn, and he stirred as I sat on the edge of his bed, jamming and releasing the lever that detached the forward grip of my gun.
Almost as good as a boy,
Damir said, surfacing momentarily from the fog of fever and brandy. From him, this was a compliment. But his leg was twice the size it should have been, and there was pus. I left the gun leaning against the bookshelf and returned to my corner of the kitchen floor. I thought of telling Drenka the whole story of where I'd come from and what had happened, but she was ripping bedding for bandages and worrying. Just as I was beginning to think I'd worked up the courage to open my mouth, a pallid face appeared above me in the kitchen window. I jumped to my feet and let out a yelp.
Psst, Indy, open up,
the face whispered through the glass. I looked again, the magnified eyes now familiar. I unbolted the door.
How's he doing?
The captain asked. He's alive, I said.
Oh, good, Josip, you're here, said Drenka from down the hall.
It was the first time I'd heard anyone call the captain by another name, but her face dropped when she came round the corner.
Where's Dr. Hoshich?
The captain lowered his eyes.
We can't find him.
What do you mean? You were supposed to... You said you were bringing a doctor.
Last we heard, he was over in Blato, but that was a few days ago.
Well, then he should be here soon, right?
Drenka.
The captain sounded almost tender now.
We don't have time.
The captain pressed by us and began banging around the kitchen, neck deep in the cabinets. When he reemerged, he was holding a paring knife and salad tongs.
We need to take it out.
Drenka collapsed into a nearby chair, and the captain turned to me.
Can you boil some water?
He said. The scream that came out of Damir was not human, guttural and even more desperate than the cries in the forest. I stood in the doorway of his bedroom, looking and trying not to look, as Drenka held Damir's arms down against the bed, and the captain bent over Damir's leg in the candlelight. I clapped my hands over my ears and ran back to the kitchen to boil more water. The canisters were almost empty. Should I go to the pump, or wait and see if they needed me here? Soon, though, the captain came out into the kitchen. He gestured to the remaining water, and I poured it over his bloody hands in the sink. He wiped his palms on his jeans, and I stood by, staring, waiting for my next order. But the captain just rested his hand on my shoulder.
It's all right, Indy,
he said, though he was looking over my head.
You can stand down. You did good.
He pushed his glasses up his nose and went out into the night. I fell asleep on the floor and woke up cold. Turning sideways, I slipped through the door of Damir's room, where Drenka was sleeping in a chair pulled close to his bed. She looked older now, skin sallow without the warm tones of her shawl up around her face. I grazed my fingers against her arm, and she jerked awake.
Zagreb,
I said, and she looked confused.
I'm from Zagreb.
The name of my city felt foreign. Drenka stood haltingly and stumbled as she led me to the couch.
Okay,
she said, covering me with a blanket.
Okay.
Chapter 3. News had spread about Damir, and the next day the women of the village came through the house offering help. They brought broth, towels, jam jars of rakia, and war cakes, flat, hard discs made with a quarter of the normal amount of yeast and no sugar. I was sitting in my corner and tried to listen for news of other safe house casualties, but since I'd spoken, Drenka had reduced herself to whispers in my presence, and the other women followed. I assumed they'd be rehashing recent events, planning what to do when the JNA came back, but instead I felt them staring at me sidelong and exchanging crinkled dinar notes. At sundown, Drenka counted the money. She took the last 2 hard-boiled eggs left from the chickens and packed them, along with a heel of bread, in a plastic sack, tying the ends of the bag tight. We were leaving. She brought me my old t-shirt, and I put it on, then pulled the sweatshirt Damir had given me back over top. While Drenka was putting on her shoes, I slipped into Damir's room.
"Thank you," I said into the darkness.
Damir muttered something and moved like he was going to roll over, but they'd strapped his leg down to the bed, and he gave up without much of a fight.
"Good night,"